Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining me this morning. I'm Lynn Langett. I'm a developer evangelist with Microsoft out of Los Angeles. And I've been doing quite a bit of work over the past year with the SQL Server and SQL Azure product teams. So I'm going to be talking to you this morning about SQL Server. So I want to be very clear in terms of what this talk is about and what it's not about. So if you have a different expectation, you can go to a different session. So let me tell you exactly what this talk will be about. So let me go ahead and click here. So this talk is a talk about the current state of SQL Server 2008 R2 SP1. There's three focus areas in this talk, and it's going to be a combination of demos and reference slides. The first focus area is going to be around database lifecycle project management, so it'll be around the current state of DACPACs. I find that many of our customers either haven't tried out DACPACs at all or tried out an earlier version. So this will be around the current release of the DACPAC offering as it relates to 2008 R2. I will show at the end of this demo set, the first demo set, where we're going in terms of SQL Server development tools, which are codenamed Juno. There is a CTP3 release, or CTP, I guess, one release that came out a couple of months ago or a month or two ago that will work with Visual Studio 2010 and 2008 with SP1. Now, to be clear, the Juno SQL Server developer tools are on a release cadence with Denali, but there is functionality with 2008. So I'm focusing on current. Does that make sense? I am not focusing on the Denali release in this talk. And I know there was some confusion when I spoke in New Zealand about that, so I want to be very clear. So I'm going to talk first about lifecycle management. The second section of the talk is going to be about T-SQL and data type enhancements. And this is really not new news, but I have found that a lot of the customers haven't had time to experience this, to enjoy this, to make this part of their applications. So I've got a set of demos in the center of this talk around these enhancements. All of my slide deck and sample code is already posted up on my blog, which is SoCal DevGal. I do see that MSDN blogs are down for maintenance, so I have two blogs. I also have a blog, Lynn Langett, L-Y-N-N-L-A-N-G-I-T. So it's duplicate. The third set in this presentation will be around the Entity Framework. And there's been quite a bit of release activity in the Entity Framework, so I've included release 4.1 and 4.2 in my demos for the Entity Framework. So that section is quite extensive. Also, this talk focuses on on-premises SQL Server. Now, all of the information that I'm sharing with you is applicable to SQL Azure. And in fact, I did a talk yesterday on developer tools and frameworks in action that's been recorded. Got some guys' radio over there. Tools and frameworks in action that shows kind of more lightweight version of this in addition to some of the tools that are specific to SQL Azure. So can somebody over maybe shut the door over there so it's not having feedback? Thanks. Okay, so that's what this talk's going to be about. I just wanted to be clear to start the day, not a focus on Denali. So if you're expecting Denali, go to a Denali focus session. This is going to be on the current stuff with the exception of including Juno. Make sense? Okay, so we'll get going on that. Thank you. Okay, so let's first talk about DACPAC and where DACPAC's coming from and why. What is DACPAC and where is it why it's been created. So basically the idea is that there are pain points around keeping your on-premise instances of SQL Server, your on-premise, your cloud, whatever, your various instances of SQL Server in sync. And most of us are either A, using scripts, or B, using a different third-party tool that we paid for. So within the Microsoft product offering, prior to DACPACs, there wasn't this concept of versioning associated with scripts around the metadata and the policies. That's the core of the DACPAC. So the idea of a DACPAC is a single unit, a DACPAC file, that contains metadata that defines the particular selected instance schema, so tables, views, so on and so forth, and policies, all the security settings, the collections of security settings. This becomes increasingly important as we, as DBAs and developers, are responsible for compliance issues on-prem and possibly in the cloud. Okay? So that is the idea of DACPAC. To get a visualization of it, the idea is that rather than just having a bunch of scripts and then applying them, you have, as it shows in the center here, this container. And the container allows you to associate the activities that you would normally do around the application of these scripts to a versionable single object. Make sense? To associate with source control, so on and so forth. Now, DACPACs got a bad reputation when they first came out because, particularly for on-prem, not all on-prem objects are supported. And so some of our customers dismissed them as, you know, lightweight and not appropriate and that kind of stuff. If that was you, I encourage you to re-examine the state of DACPACs today, because as we're adding functionality to DACPACs, we're also adding support for more of the on-prem features. One thing that's also interesting about DACPACs, if you happen to be working with cloud instances, is from the beginning, all features of SQL Azure have been supported by DACPACs. So the idea is that we have this single unit to version all of our information that can be accessed through our various tools, whether it's Management Studio, Visual Studio, or we actually have a set of APIs that you as a developer can write to or third-party vendors can write to. So how can you work with DACPACs? What do DACPACs look like? Let's go ahead and switch over to demo. All right, so the first, let me make sure this switched okay. No. I guess I have to hold it. All right, where's my magic switch? 1, 2. All right, I need a tech guy because my switcher thing's not working. Tech person guy. No tech guy, okay, all right. Push and hold the button should switch, right? Kind of hard to demo if I can't show the demo machine. No tech guy in the room? All right, let me try something weird, because I'm a hacker kind of a gal. Okay, so 2, right? 2. Press and hold. Press and... Nope.
It's supposed to work.
Yeah, it's supposed to work. Yeah. Oh, okay, it's going. Just real quick, looks like. Switching? Okay, got it. So it's Tinder. Thank you. If I had swag, I'd give it to the guy. Okay, so we are in Management Studio. Okay, so we're in Management Studio 2008 R2 SP1. And I've got Zoom It so that, you know, we can all see what we're doing. And we have a 10.0, so it's, you know, it's 2008. Of course, Denali is 11. By the way, if you're testing out Denali, I'll tell you I actually have Denali on this machine and they run fine side by side. So if you have that sort of situation. All right, so the world of DACPACs, how do they work? So if I want to create a DACPAC from Management Studio, it's all a wizard-driven process. So I'm going to go in here, and I have two options. Again, you can use PowerShell, you can use other ways to do this. You can extract, or you can register, okay? So I will just do it against, let's see, I'll just pick something here. I'll do it against this dating game. And I'll say tasks, extract, and I'll get a wizard, and it's going to say, I'm going to set the properties. The most important thing here is, of course, the version, because you have the one artifact for all of your metadata. Okay? Now, it's given me a warning because I've already created one with the same name, so I have to give it a unique name. So I'll call it DACPAC 5 or Dating Game 5 or something, and save. And then I can put some description. I can say test for tech ed. And I could overwrite an existing file if I had one. And it'll first check all the objects in the database to make sure that the DACPAC can understand what they are. And it'll give you a warning if it can't. And here it's listing all the various objects. So, you know, you've got, you know, tables, and you've got information schema and a couple of roles. And then you say next. And it's going to build the package. Okay? Now, while this is cooking, like a cooking show here, I will take a pre-built package because you, I'm sure, are curious as to what are the contents of this package. So you'll notice that I have a package already built from earlier here, just a copy of it, and I'm going to right click it and I'm going to unpack it. Okay? So I'm going to unpack it and it'll unpack, which is basically an unzip. Now you have two ways that you can see the contents of this. You could rename it as a .zip file and see it, but or you can unpack it. So inside of here, you have a couple of XML files and a SQL script. So it's not really a mysterious thing. It's versioning around the metadata. Okay? Make sense? Versioning around the metadata. And to this point, you're probably, maybe, not super excited. It's not super interesting until you start to see how it's designed to work with the tools. So anyway, so my package is built. All right, so the next thing that I would want to do is I would want to register this. Now, when you register a DAC pack, what you're doing is you're making it available for monitoring from the utility access control point, which is a new capability built into 2008. Again, I've not seen as many customers as I'd like take advantage of this. A lot of people have third-party tools to do monitoring against resource utilization of their particular database instances. What you're monitoring here is you're monitoring the state of the DAC pack. Did it change? Okay? So I'm registering this, and again, I'm saying for the particular version, and then I can put a description, and then it's registering it. Now, once it registers the DAC pack, then you'll see it in the management node down in the bottom. Now, one of the new things, so you see it down here, is that, and this has been kind of a quiet improvement in DAC pack, is that in the first release, if you made changes, you had to drop and recreate the database, which, you know, again, was not the ideal scenario for a lot of situations. But what now is the case, is kind of interesting, is if you have a registered DAC pack, you can, of course, delete it, but more interesting is you can upgrade a data to your application. And the idea with the lifecycle management is you use declarative information, basically just create information, and then the tools figure out the best way to manage the upgrade process. So you can see inside of here, you select the particular package that you would want to use, and I can select, you know, the one I just had. Well, maybe I'll select a previous one because it probably has something, some other, we'll see if there's some differences. And there it says, no, it doesn't match, because I've made some significant changes. So I'll select this one just for purposes of showing. And still, because it doesn't match the application name, because it's called Dating Game New, I think. Can't remember the name. Have to go ahead and change. And then it would detect the changes. And then the most important part is you can either apply the changes or you can save the scripts out and then run them whenever you want to. The big idea here is that the DAC pack is the container that is versionable. So instead of going, which version of that T-SQL script was applied to that table? I can't remember. The DAC pack is the container. Make sense? Okay, so now we're going to move over to Management Studio and see how this works from the developer standpoint. So in Management Studio, in Visual Studio, I'm going to say File, New, Project. And in SQL Server, I'm going to select data to your application. So that's how DAC pack is called in Visual Studio. So in Management Studio, of course, your DBA might be creating DAC packs, applying DAC packs to create instances, upgrading DAC packs, or monitoring. Oh, sorry, I should show that. Let me switch back. So what does a monitored DAC pack look like? If you've never seen the utility access control point, here's the browser, Utility Explorer, and then you set up, it gives you a set of wizards on how to set this up. You basically just select a server instance, and then it creates a metadata database to store the information, and then any registered DAC packs will show up on your dashboard here. And let me show you how that looks. There we go. So you can see that it automatically shows up, and it shows you the utilization. It's like a dashboard, so a red, green, yellow dashboard in terms of your CPU utilization, your disk space utilization, so on and so forth. And again, I know there are quite a few really good third-party tools out there that do this, But I think it's important that you understand that you also have the option to use the tools that you got with the product and to see how DAC packs work with them. So you can drill into this DAC pack, you can see CPU utilization, you can see storage utilization, you can see the policy details, which I'll just go through this real quick, like, so you can see what it looks like. Here's your log files. You can see the percentage used on the file group. On the policy details, you can see the CPU utilization policies that you can set. Again, some of you might have had the time to explore some of these features in 2008, but I find a lot of customers haven't. So file space utilization, so on and so forth. So that's what the monitoring looks like. Okay? All right, sorry. Now let me switch over to Visual Studio. So your DBA is doing the monitoring, the upgrading, the creating of the physical databases. What might your developer be doing? Well, they're creating applications for end users to make changes or view that data. So I'm going to create a new DAC pack application here. I'm going to call this for TechEd Australia and say OK. And that's going to create me in Visual Studio a solution template with a number of nodes that are supportive of the DAC pack. So what are those nodes? So you can see I have schema objects, scripts, schema comparisons, and data generation plans. Okay? And I've started with a blank DAC pack template here. So there are a number of different things I could do to work with my DAC pack inside of Visual Studio. So if I right click up at the top, I can import a script. I can import a data tier application that maybe my DBA has created and ready to hand off to me. Now this option right here, convert to SQL Server database project, this is here because of SQL Server developer tools or Juno. This is sort of the evolution of where we're going with this lifecycle management. So you would have to install the Juno CTP to see this in Visual Studio, okay? So all right, so let's start by importing a data tier application. So let's pick one. And now we have two things that we could do. I could infer one from a SQL Server instance, create one, if you will, or I could import one. Okay? So if I wanted to import one, I'd have to go to the correct location here. So let me get this path and bring this in here and pick one. And I'm going to import the server selection policy as well and say import. And that's going to pull in that DAC pack for me as a developer to see that schema, to work with that schema, to create applications against it, and possibly to change the schema in a way that I need to support my application requirements. And I'm going to say finish. Okay? So now what does that give me? Well, the thing that's probably most significant is at the schema level, it gives me all my scripts that I need. Now, I have a little sample database I use for demonstration purposes for my regular job, and also I do some volunteer work with kids, introducing kids to SQL. And this database is the boyfriend database. It's for high school girls. It's not my boyfriend's. It's for the high school girls, okay? So inside of here, I can get some good functionality around working with SQL. So there's my table if I want to make a change, so on and so forth. And I could get some good functionality. Now, if I wanted to, for example, create a new view, so I'm going to say new view, then I can work inside of here, and I'll call this a girl names, say add, because I'm making a change for my application. Now, inside of here, wow, what's that? IntelliSense. Now, the reason I have IntelliSense is, again, not in the current version. I'm trying to be very clear about what's current and what's future. This comes from the Juno tools. Now, the Juno tools are going to have very, very wonderful IntelliSense. I spent a couple weeks in Seattle in July seeing all the Denali stuff. What we have in this release is we have two out of the three IntelliSense scenarios enabled. So what we don't have, and I inadvertently demonstrated this yesterday, and I'm telling you this because if you get the Juno tools, it says IntelliSense everywhere. I don't, unless they changed it. On the native query, the IntelliSense isn't enabled yet. It will be when it's a final release. But when you have a new object to create, they did get the IntelliSense in here. It was really confusing to me. So I just want to make sure you understand, if you get the tools, it's not fully enabled in Juno because it's beta, but it will be when it's a final. Okay, make sense? So anyway, so I can use wonderful IntelliSense here and have great productivity. It must be a view I have already. So I want girlfriends. Okay, and then I can make a star here and check this out. This is pretty cool. See that? I can see all the column names like that. And again, I know some of you already have other tools that you know and love, and that's fine. But you know, I do have that blue badge, so it is my job to show you what's in the Microsoft product stack. So, okay, so I'm going to call this girl names one because I think I might already have this in here, and say save. Okay? So now, what can I do with this? All right, so I've made some changes to the schema. So I can do a couple things. First of all, if I were to build and if there were problems with this in terms of T-SQL being invalid, it would actually give me warnings. Now you might say, well, wouldn't that show up in the editor? It may and it may not. It's actually just like writing C# code, because what happens is you have version targeting inside of here. So I'm going to show you. So you can say properties. And you can see that this is targeted for a DAC pack, if I can go over here, and that you have the ability to target for 2008 or 2005. Because again, this is not Denali yet. Okay, we're not in Denali yet. So you can either build for a DAC pack 2008 or 2005. Okay? And it'll give you the version information. All right, so let me close out of here. Oh, I wanted to show you one other thing in there, sorry. Notice. Very important thing, most important thing about DAC packs, you see we've got versioning inside of here as well. Because I'm the developer and I've created a new version of this. You see that? That's the key takeaway. That's what a DAC pack is and does. It is a container for version numbers. Sounds silly, maybe, or insignificant, but I think it's really significant. So I think it's worth showing you. Okay, so going on here, now we're going to... we can go ahead and we can build. Now, if we deploy this, it's going to fail. Anybody have any idea why it will fail? Because we didn't tell it where to deploy. Okay, so let me show you how that is. So I'm going to build. It built okay. And I'm going to deploy, and it will fail because it'll say, there is no connection string. You see that? Before you can deploy, you must specify a connection string. That's the other key idea with the DAC. It is this container that you can deploy anywhere. And when you deploy it, you can version target it. So for example, if you're working on-prem, this is all on-prem. If you're working with 2008 and suddenly you have to deploy it to 2005 because you're out of space on your 2008 instance server or something, you can set it to 2005 and you can get all those warnings for 2008 features you might have used. Handy. All versioned, all contained. Okay? All right, so to do that, I would have to go to the connection properties, and I would have to specify a connection string somewhere here, deploy, under deploy, and I would have to edit that and specify a deployment target. So let's say that I specify there, and then I call it dating game new 15 or something, and then it would deploy as a new instance. Make sense? Okay. So other things that are available in DAC packs that are quite useful is this idea of a schema compare. So if I say a new schema comparison, what I can do is I can compare a schema from one location to another. So you see that I have these various options. I have the project, I have a database, or I have something called a database file. And we'll come back to that in just a minute. So I can compare from and to. And then it's going to give me a line-by-line comparison of the schema and the policy. And again, I know there's some third-party tools that do this, but kind of neat stuff. All right. So to show some of those third-party tools, I'm actually going to create a new solution. And I'm going to create, I should have said, not the third-party tools to show Juno. And I'm going to just create a console app. Juno. And say yes. Now, one of the things you can do is you can upgrade a DAC pack to a SQL Server SSDT project. But I think it's actually simpler for me to just make a new one because you can see some of the changes. So if I bring up Server Explorer, one of the things to note when you install the Juno tools is that you get a new node. We have our sort of classic or traditional data connections, and that's going to stay there because we're used to working with that in Visual Studio, where you can connect to a database and see the information and so on and so forth and write queries. But we have this new node that is one of the ways that we see Juno. So inside of here, we've connected, and you can connect to, you know, any sort of tool set that you want to. So you can connect to 2008, you can connect to Denali, you can connect to Azure. So I've connected, and it looks very similar. You know, very similar. And you can work in a connected fashion. But one of the really interesting things that Juno brings is the ability to work in a disconnected fashion. So if you create a new Juno project, and I'll call this Dating Game Juno, you'll see that it's going to look similar, Juno test, to a DAC pack, and that's why I'm showing this. But it's not the same. It has more functionality. So there we go. And look what it's doing. Import of database schema. That looks kind of familiar, doesn't it? Gathering database options. Okay? It's getting all the metadata. Very similar conceptually to a DAC pack. But yet not the same, not the same, okay? So remember, we had our DAC pack up here, and we had the ability to, once this comes up, oh, I think it did it already, all right. So here's our, yeah, so here's our project. So this is our Juno project. Now, if we look on the top, our import is different. We can import a database. We can import something called a snapshot. We can import a script. Or, most interestingly, we can import a data tier application into an SSDT project. Okay? So forward-looking around database lifecycle management. So what I've done, though, is I've created a project based on an existing database. So now what can I do? Well, first of all, I have to build. I can't do anything until I build. Okay? And we got a good build, so that's good. And then, perhaps before I start developing, I want to take a baseline snapshot. So this is that new capability. So I'm going to snapshot the project. And it's going to create a new type of file, a SQLX file. Okay? A SQLX file. So I've got this snapshot, and I can rename it as a dating game baseline, I don't know, demo or something. Okay. Oh, so let me see. Oh, I got to keep the right extension, though. So let me just say, sorry. So say dating game base. There we go. Okay. So now I can go in and I can, again, make a change. Let me make a change to a table. Let's make a change to a table. Now remember when I opened the table before in the DAC pack project, the table designer, it was like a SQL designer. One of the things you have in Juno is you have a new table designer. And it's got, you know, these enhancements to support the different ways that people work. Some people prefer to work in an English-like pane. So I'm going to change column name here. Now watch what happens to the SQL down below when I go tab through this. See how that automatically changes? See that? Watch if I add an index. I go add new index, and I call this, I don't know, I'll call it name or something. Now it gives me a stub down at the bottom, and I can then fill that in. And I have to put in a column name. So let me put in that English name. And this will eventually have IntelliSense as well. And so now I save this, okay? So now I've made some changes to my model that I'm working on in Visual Studio. And I want to understand how my model has changed. Now I can compare to several different things. So if I go inside of here, I can do my schema compare. And I was showing, as I was showing you before, you can schema compare from your project, and you can go back to the live database if you want to. But what I think is more interesting is you can go out to that baseline snapshot, and let me pull up the location for that, so that you can have these snapshots and you can avoid the overhead of running the query, if you will, against some kind of running database. So now we can run this and we can do a schema compare. And then I'll get rid of this so you can see how it looks. And you can see it, there's the change that we made, of course. And then, of course, we would have the index change as well. And then just like everything else in the lifecycle management, you could apply the changes or you could generate a script. Okay? Making sense? Are you seeing the enhancements we're doing to lifecycle management? I think they're very significant. I think they're very significant and they warrant a look by you guys as our SQL community. So I'm going to switch back, hopefully, I'm going to try. I need that guy to come up here and be my demo buddy. Is it here? Ah, that's why. Okay, it's on the bottom. Those tricky buggers. Okay. All right, so let's go through some of this. So I showed you DACPAC. I showed you importing from script, database, or DACPAC. Okay. I showed you the schema level objects. There's pre and post deployment scripts. I showed you that there are data generation plans and schema comparisons inside of DACPACs. I showed you the schema comparison from Juno, which is more sophisticated, and that's what that looks like. And then that's data generation. And then that's what build and deploy looks like. We got into the demo. I showed you the monitoring on the UCP. And then I didn't actually demo that, but if you right-click on a DACPAC and you have Juno installed, that's what the screen looks like to convert to an SSDT project. Now, if this whole part of this talk is intriguing you, in the slide deck, I have references to full one-hour sessions on DACPAC and SSDT from TechEd North America that are recorded. So I'm trying to kind of interest you in some of these enhancements to the product so you'll go out and you'll learn even more and try them out. Okay? All right. So that's the lifecycle management. So the next part that we want to get into is once you've thought of how you're going to manage the lifecycle of your 2008 or earlier instances, what are you going to do to make optimal use of what I call the smart data typing inside of the instances? Now, there's a couple different parts to this. The first part is using T-SQL intelligently. And you might say, well, gosh, I'm a developer. Aren't I supposed to use Link for everything? Yes, using Link is a good practice. However, I guess I come from the database side, so I'm not going to step away from my T-SQL, not for a long time. There's lots of good and powerful stuff in T-SQL. And being a developer evangelist, I work more with people who write C-sharp or some other VB or PHP or Java code than people who write T-SQL, and they're constantly arguing with me that T-SQL is not an important language, and I love to prove them wrong by showing them some of these demos, so we'll see if this is helpful to you. The T-SQL demos I'm going to show you are not new. They're with 2008, but I see a lot of developers not using these enhancements. So we'll start with those. And they include things like table-valued parameters, row constructors, grouping sets, and merge statements. And again, I have a slide to summarize this, why you care about this, but I think it's more interesting to actually look at a demo of this. So let me switch over and close out of this and start going here. So again, all this sample code is on my blog, so you can grab it right after this if you're interested in you know, having some sample code. So the very first enhancement is just something that our customers have been asking for a while. It's an idea of passing in and working with table-valued parameters and stored procedures, so you can pass in arrays in a more elegant way. So let me, again, just close this out so you can see this really well. So what I have going on here is I am going to use AdventureWorks, and I'm going to create an order ID type as a table. Okay, so you can think of this as my array, if you will. So it has position and order ID, and then I'm just going to add some values into that. So add some various values, my array, if you will. And then the important part, I'm going to create a stored procedure, getOrders, that uses that type, so that passes in that type, and then I'm going to return the result. So pretty simple. So I'm going to create the type here and connect, and then I'm going to add some values in. There's my values, and then the, you know, like I said, the important part, if you will, which is creating the procedure. Okay, and then that procedure is going to use that type. And then I'm going to, then I'm going to pass some values in, and I'm simply going to run it. It's a simpler way to code up something. That's all. It's just an efficiency. It's not earth-shattering, but we all want to be more efficient at what we're doing day in and day out. So we just simply run it, and there it is. And then for a reset, you can just get rid of the procedure and the type. Okay? So again, I know it's not earth-shattering stuff, but I just find a lot of people that are using our products are not aware of some of these enhancements. So the next one is the merge command. Merge command combines an insert, update, and delete into a single statement based on conditional logic. Okay? So what we're going to do is we'll have a little bit of setup here. We'll just use tempdb. So we're going to create a table, couple tables, customers and customer information. And then we've got a stage table. So we're going to put some information into there. So let me set those two tables up. So customers and customers. Okay, so I got the two tables and I put the information in. Okay, so now this is the salient part. Okay, so let me make it so you can see this. So you have these different conditions, and really the T-SQL reads as much like English as the English. So you have a target and a source table. So you have the customer table, the stage table, target and source, okay? When matched, then update, set the values. When not matched, then insert, okay? And then when not matched in the target or the source. And when not matched, then delete. So again, not earth-shattering, but it allows you to write more efficient SQL. So you merge in, and you're going to say, in this condition, do an update. In this condition, do an insert. In this condition, do a delete. Okay? And then have the output. And then there you go. Okay? And there you go. So just out of curiosity, how many people are using Merge? Raise your hand. Cool. So about a third. So I know for some of you, you're using it, you're liking it, but two-thirds are not yet. So you should try it out. Okay, next thing, grouping sets. I taught basic T-SQL for years. I'm a Microsoft certified trainer. I still am, 12 years. And I remember teaching the group by and cube and roll up and all this. And this, again, just like many of these other efficiencies, just makes a common query pattern simpler. So in this case, we want multiple groupings. So we've got a table. Okay, and we've got, you know, just some various columns in there about our orders. Okay, So we want to have multiple groupings. So let's set up our table. There it is. Okay. So now we want to use grouping sets. Okay. So this is kind of neat if you've never seen it before. So you've got this new grouping sets operator. So we're going to group by this value, this value, this value. That's kind of clear. Probably the one that's not as clear is this last one. So it's an empty group. As it says, similar to an aggregate query with no group by clause. You treat the whole table as a group. So it's just a simpler way of doing multiple grouping. So here we go. We do multiple grouping. And there you can see the result. Okay, again, just show of hands, how many people are using grouping sets? Less. Okay, so try them out if you're doing multiple groupings. Very, very common query pattern. It's interesting, I actually know one of the guys who's responsible for this. His name is Tobias Thernstrom. He came out of the MVP community, and we hired him because he was just so great at criticizing the T-SQL language. So we actually hired him. He's done a fantastic presentation on this for like an hour, almost every major conference, and he is actually now on the core T-SQL language team. Just one of the best T-SQL guys in the world. I had the pleasure of working with him on a project for 2 weeks once, and it was fantastic. It's really neat to see the power of the MVP community. Not only him, but he and some other MVPs have actually impacted the T-SQL language, so I'm proud of it. All right, so the next thing is sparse columns. Columns that are optimized for the storage of nulls, okay? So very simple. You add the sparse keyword, okay? Now, why you care about this is a better use of your actual storage. And once you create this, it looks just like regular SQL. So there's only you add the sparse column. That's it. So, you know, I've got a table. I put some stuff in there. I designate some columns as sparse. Done. Good. Okay. And then I populate some values, and then I query it. Okay. Now, that's interesting. All right. And then there's the query. But what is even more interesting is... And there shows the sparsity, if you will. There's the sparsity. Is that you can combine this with another couple of new features around accounting for sparse situations. And I'll show you what those are. The first one is a filtered index. Okay? So filtered indexes, you can think of them as partial indexes. So rather than indexing a complete column, they are specifically designed to index subsets, more efficient, because the smaller thing that you query, the faster the query, so on and so forth. There's two situations you can create them. One is you can specify the condition, as is done here, or you could, and I didn't actually put this in the demo, create an index on a sparse column. Okay? So the first thing I'm going to show you is... inside of here, I'm going to show you, and I'll do the query plan so you can see, let's see the actual query plan. So you can see that before we have this new index, we use just the regular clustered index. Okay, I have the right database, always helps. Okay, and then I'm going to just use the regular clustered index. So the query optimizer looks for this, is my point, basically. So, and then did I run, there we go, the execution plan. And let me bring this up. So you can see that right now we're using the clustered index, right? So we go ahead and we create a non-clustered index where this is not null, which is a filtered index. Okay, and we run that. And then we rerun this query, and the query optimizer will be smart enough to use, you see that? The non-clustered index. You see? Okay. How many people in here are using filtered indexes? Awesome. So probably of the things that I've showed you, this is the most applicable to query optimization, because unless you're very strict about not allowing nulls in your databases. So very cool. So that's the syntax for that. And again, you can just get this right off my blog, so you can, you know, have it. And then the very last thing is, if you have a situation, this is more for data warehousing scenarios, where you have lots of sparse columns, you can create what's called an XML column set. So an XML column set for all sparse columns. And what that does, it's further optimizes it, if you will. So inside of here, we say use tempdb. We create this guy. Say okie dokie. We populate it. Sorry, I think that was a little American. I'm trying not to get very American. I don't think you say okie dokie in Australia. I'm slipping. Okay, and then I select. There we are. And then you can, oops, there's my microphone. You can pass XML in as well. And I'll pass it in. And then select in and out. And there's my XML results. So, again, these are simple things, but these are the reasons we use a relational database. One of the things that it's been interesting to me with the cloud is all this talk about NoSQL. You know, NoSQL is great, and relational databases are dead, and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, I beg to differ, okay? NoSQL has its place, but I do believe that if we fully understand what our relational databases have to offer, that we will use them when appropriate. In fact, I just found out, it's funny the things you find out when you're not at home, that I've been assigned to write the paper for Microsoft on NoSQL versus relational. So I'm going to be doing a little more work on that. Anyway, okay, so data type enhancements. I put a huge amount of notes in the slides here too. So if you're interested in this, I didn't show all of them because, you know, that's a whole hour talk. I focused on the T-SQL, and then I talked about the sparse column, XML. Of course, we have geospatial. Most people seem to have discovered that. We have file stream enhancements. It's native, part of the storage now, part of the engine, and full text enhancements. So I'm going to just keep on going so we can get into the entity framework stuff. And this talks a little bit more. Okay, so let's move into EF. All right, world of EF. First of all, again, last time I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. How many people are using Entity Framework? Good. Okay. This is a weird microphone. It's my goal by the time I'm done today that all of you will be using Entity Framework. Entity Framework is the new ADO.NET, basically. And it's such a huge part of what we're doing at Microsoft. And we are making so many improvements to it so fast. I spent so many hours preparing for these presentations because I have future-looking information that will be announced coming soon, and I found that I needed to spend time to understand what we had, understand where we're going. So I'm trying to use. I'll be using the majority of the rest of the time to share this with you to help you to be prepared. All right, so let's get started. EF, it's object relational. Framework, how you might use it. You are going to use it in one of three fashions that I will show all three different ways. You will generally write most of your queries using link to entities. Okay, link to SQL is still there, but most of you will be moving to link to entities. Another thing to know is that you can use native T-SQL with Entity Framework. There is a method. I actually put it in my other slide deck. I believe it's SQL query. It's the name of the method. I think that's quite important. I'm a very big believer in use the most efficient method for accessing the database. Now, I realize that some developers do not have expertise in T-SQL, but the things that, for example, I just showed you, if link doesn't appropriately generate grouping sets or things like that, you might want to use that type of access. Or with Entity Framework. All right. So why use Entity Framework? It gives you a huge amount of plumbing that allows you to focus on the business logic. So the very first thing, Entity Framework. You have three ways of working, okay? And this gets into such a religious debate with people. Actually, it's funny. My boyfriend's a Java developer, believe it or not. And he said, I only care about database first. All that other stuff is just unnecessary. And then I was giving my presentation yesterday and somebody asked me about code first and I said, see, you're wrong. Because certain people prefer to work different ways. So what does this mean? When you are creating your application, you can work with any framework with these different methods. Database first. I have a database. I want to now use Entity Framework to access that database to write an application. Model first. I prefer to draw my model in Visual Studio and create a database from that model that I will have my application access. Okay? Code first. This is the new one, new in 4.1. I prefer to write classes, basic classes. They're often called POCO classes, plain old object classes, I think. I prefer to write, think in terms of customers, products, and their attributes. And I wish to generate the other artifacts, the models and the databases from Entity Framework through Visual Studio. Okay? So you know what is most appropriate for your particular situation, and you might use more than one. Entity Framework supports all three types. Okay? So the very first thing that you're going to want to do is download the most current versions of Entity Framework. Okay? 4.1 is the most current production version. I have links in my deck. 4.2 is a beta. Okay? That's where we're at right now. There will be more releases soon. So watch the team blog. Okay, there will be more functionality coming soon. The other thing that you're going to want is you're going to want Entity Framework Power Tools. They're fantastic, particularly if you're going to use model or code first. I'll actually jump over and show you what they look like so I don't forget to show you that, because I'm more of a database first kind of person. There we go. But I have done model and code first in preparation for this talk. So let me find the tools here. So let's see, I'm going to go tools, and I'm going to go extension manager. So again, to get all the parts and pieces, you're going to want the Entity Framework itself, the Entity Framework 4.1 at least, possibly 4.2, and you're going to want the power tools. Okay? So if you've not used this before, you can just go out here. You can also get this through NuGet. But this adds some wonderful tools, and I believe these are still beta, but they work great for working with model first or code first. Okay, so let me switch back over here and go on. All right, so the first thing that you're going to see when you work with Entity Framework is you're going to see a series of different templates. One of the things that was quietly added in 4.1 was a new core object. And I'm going to spend some time helping you to understand which object for which situation. So the first thing you have is the type of development. Model first, database first, model first, or code first. The second thing you have is the type of object. And the first object is object context. And the second object is DB context. So you can see that you have here entity data model on the top, and then you have DB context on the bottom. Okay? So here's the deal, and I'll show you in code as well. Object context is the sort of big, chubby one that has all the methods and all the power of Entity Framework. It's the one you get sort of by default. There's over 50 different properties and methods, object context. So our customers said, hey, it's too complicated. So we came in on 4.1 with DB context. DB context is the skinny, attractive cousin of object context. Has 15 properties and methods. Simpler. Okay? Do you understand? DB context is just a subset of object context. Very important, because you might be looking for a method on DB context and not find it there. Go to object context. Okay. All right. Let's not go there yet. All right, let's go into demo. So let's start a new instance of Visual Studio. See how many instances I can run on this old machine. and start this from scratch. I have one fully cooked too, but I want to show you the whole thing from scratch. One of the other things while this is coming up, I'll note that I'm going to turn on is our friend SQL Server Profiler. From the database background that I come from, I like to know what Entity Framework is doing. And if you're working with on-premise and you have access to SQL Server Profiler, one of the things you can do is you can set, I'll show you how to do it, you can set your trace so that you only collect events of type Entity Framework, which is very handy. So you can actually see the SQL that is generated. So that's what we'll be doing. Now, you can only do that with on-premise because Profiler is not enabled for SQL Azure because of security reasons at this point. There are other types of tracing that you can use. In fact, I've put a reference in this deck to the types of tracing available for Entity Framework. There's a really good blog post somebody did about it. So I will be turning this on when we go to the main part. Okay, so I start with a blank project here, and I'm going to say File, New, Project. And I'll just do something sort of classic and simple, and I'll say simple, create a console app. And then, you know, I'm going to have some console app that works with Entity Framework, so I'm going to do database first. So for database first, and this will use the more heavyweight object, if you will, I'm going to say add, and say new item. So this assumes an existing database. And then I'm going to keep talking. There we go. All right, I'm talking. There we go. So inside of here, I have entity data model. And sorry, you guys. Dating game. Okay? So this is the classic one. And this is going to give you the object context. Now, inside of here, you're going to say generate from database or empty model. Generate from database assumes database first. Empty model assumes model first. You're going to draw it. Okay? So now I can choose the model contents from my on-prem, if you will. And then I can generate. I feel if I don't move my head, my microphone will continue to work. Presenter challenges, right? Wrong. There we go. All right, so again, what is happening here? We are making a reference, a couple references, to data entity, data set extensions, entity framework type objects, and we are getting our model. Oh, great. I think it's the battery. Yeah. Try it now? Okay. Thank you. Okay, so here's the problem. What can I do? I don't know. And instead of here, I could work with this model in a number of ways. I could add an entity. I could use an entity designer here. So I could work with the model this way. I could work with the properties. So I could look at the table mapping, work with it this way. So a lot of graphical ways to work with the model. Okay? But this model itself, under the hood, exposes, I can bring it up here, our friend, the object context. So remember, all I did is I right-clicked, there's the context, and let me click off of here. And this is the heavyweight one. Okay, so the EDMX, the classic sort of entity framework, database first, exposes object context. So what do you do with this? Okay, how does it work? Well, once you have this exposed, then you can take this and expose it a number of different ways to your client. Let me close out of here so I can show you how to do it. So here I have one fully cooked, okay? So what I've done is I've taken a pattern, which is to expose this as a data service. And this is exposing it via OData, which is an open standard. It's like a REST head. Okay? And I've done the simplest possible configuration where I've said, just allow everything. Okay? So it's a like a WCF service, but with an open standard, if you will. So to look at this, you just right-click and view in browser. And it'll show you plain old XML. Again, for demonstration purposes only, no, you know, fancy security here. There it is. And then to consume it, and there's the URL. Okay? To consume it, I've just written simplest possible client. Oops, I should show you this here. Let me open this and view in browser, and let me copy the URL because this is going to be the endpoint. The difference from a classic WCF service is that this is OData. So it can be returned as XML or JSON or something like that. So I've got a console app here. And in here, in service references, I'm going to add a certain, and I've already done this, but I'll just show you what it looks like. Add a service reference. And just to show you how lazy I was, you see that I have the entities there. It's that same database. But I don't have any operations, which you normally would define operations, because you're not going to give, you know, full table access. Okay? So inside of there, once I have this service reference, which is aliased as dating game, then it's very, very simple to create a context. So this is a client for object context. So dating game, and then you say, you know what, you have, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, they're just simply exposed as your entities. Sorry if I can get the dots, you guys can see it. So your tables are exposed as your entities. And then you have a URI, or an endpoint, which is that OData endpoint. It's being hosted on this machine, of course. And then you just use a link query and from the context. Of course, you can select. This is your big list, right? This is the big list. Either an object, or you can, you know, do something like make changes, so on and so forth. And then iterate over. Now, because I promised I'd show you what was happening here, let me turn on the trace that is configured for EF. And let me now run this. Make sure the trace is on. Is it running? Yeah, it looks like it. Okay, and let me run this. And then we can, you know, basically see how the link query is translated once we have hit the OData point. Does it make sense? Okay, so I'm going to go over here to the... Oh, and I probably didn't turn it on right. Let me just, looks like it just paused too much. Let me just run this because it's kind of cool to see. So I'll just set this up really fast and go in here. It's the DBA in me that wants to always see the SQL and entity framework. Say OK, turn it on, say run. OK, go back over here, go here, get out of here. Close and then rerun. Making sense? Sorry, I'm going a little fast. Okay, then run that. There we go. And then over here, why is my trace not? I'm probably capturing the wrong instance. Sorry, I'm hurrying a little bit. That is how you do it. I've got the Denali instance on here, and I'm probably capturing the wrong instance. So you configure it, and then you see the query is basically what you do. Okay. So for the purposes of time, I'm just going to pass by that. All right. The one thing I do definitely want to show you, though, is the other way of working. Okay, so we have the database first, or the model first, with the heavyweight object, right? Now we're going to switch, and we're going to do the other world, which is the POCO classes. Now there's two ways to do that. You can just write them, okay? Or I'm going to add a new project here. you can use those fantastic tools that I was talking about, and you can infer them. Okay, now you'd have to infer them from something, so you can infer them from an existing database. Okay, so I'm making a new console app, and inside of here, I'm right-clicking, and notice this. This is what the tool adds. The entity framework, you see that? It's hard to see because it has a little flyout menu. Entity framework, reverse engineer code first. That's what the tool adds. Like this very much. So I click here, and I go out, and I connect to a server, and then I'm going to pick a database. And instead of getting the EDMX model, what I'm going to get are POCO classes. Let's see. What got to get the right server name. Trying to go fast here. I'll pick someone else's. Haha, just kidding. Isn't that funny how it always advertises? Okay, so I say okay. Say okay. And now it's cooking. So you notice on the bottom, loading schema information. Okay. It's going to keep cooking. Oh, look at this. Check this out. What did it do? Well, first of all, it added a reference to the new Entity Framework 4.1. Okay, that's the POCO support. And then inside of here, we got not diagrams. We got POCO classes. See? Here's the POCO classes. So there they are. Nifty, huh? Is that nifty? I like that a lot. And even better, you have this additional thing from the tooling that allows you to view these classes as models, view them as XML, or view them as SQL. I just really like this. I just really like this flexibility. I'm a database first gal. I mean, you can tell, right? Like, I'm not really into writing the POCO classes. That's supported, too. But I like that I have this full functionality, okay? And to be clear, the way I got this was with 4.1 Entity Framework and the Entity Framework Power Tools. So now if I say View Data Model, I get the best of both worlds because the data model is going to render. I got to go on the context. Let me go to the context and view the data model from the context. There we go. Because it gave me a little error. It said, hey, you're on a POCO class, not a context. See that? Same thing. Check it out. But if you go into the dating game context, don't be confused. We've got DB context, not object context. Got it? Object context is the heavyweight object. And I mean, again, it's not like the most difficult thing in the world, but I'm trying to take, I know we at Microsoft can be like less than concise. And I'm trying to take what took me a long time to distill down and share that with you. I would tend to use DB context, and I would tend to use the reverse engineer. That's why I'm showing you these tools. I'm not saying that the old-fashioned EDMX is not good anymore, but I would tend to use this. All right, and then I have a client set up with this, and the client, so I again, like a cooking show, I've set this up, the reverse engineer, and I just set up a client that doesn't even bother to go anywhere, and it's the same client. I didn't expose it as a service. I just cheated and used the same project, and then you just iterate over it. Making sense? Making sense? One of my goals was to try to make this simpler. I know I was speaking very quickly, but one of the things I found in trying to get myself up to speed in Entity Framework, because of the amount of information in the releases, I was feeling a little bit overwhelmed. So I think one of the things that we could do better is make simpler demos and make a simpler on-ramp for people so you could get started with it. So that's really what I was trying to do. All right, let me switch back. Okay, so what I was showing is I showed you the power tools. I didn't show this. I didn't show that. Again, you know how I was talking about we're building Entity Framework into everything? There's a great presentation from TechEd US that shows how to create an MVC app and how to, you know, use Entity Framework. My point is, again, with this database audience, that if you're not using it, you're not using the Microsoft tools the way they were designed to be used, because we're incorporating Entity Framework into just so much stuff. And there's what it looks like. The controllers are automatically created. 4.2, add some more templates. It's on Visual Studio Gallery. Oh, I did put this in here. All right, and then there I added that code so you can see how that looks to expose a WCF OData service, because again, that's a coding scenario for a lot of people. The simple code to access. There is about the profiling, and I've got links in to different places to profile. That's what the profiling looks like when you capture the correct database instance. Sorry for that. And there's that, I was right, the method is SQL query. It's my friend. You can use raw T-SQL in combination with link, which I think is a great tip. I got that from a Entity Framework Unplug session internally, because there are times. That's not a good example, but there are times. Okay. In addition, we quietly added some new features in SP1. I showed you in Management Studio that for DACPAC we now have upgrade, which is actually a pretty important feature. One other like small thing, but really important, if you happen to use Power Pivot, there is a configuration setting now for disk space control, which is actually kind of super important for Power Pivot. A couple more DMVs and some index hints as well. Okay, so I talked quickly. I hope you found this worth your time. I took, you know, 5 one-hour presentations, really, and tried to take the best of to bring them together, because even for me, a person who's been working with SQL Server for 10 years, there's so much new stuff that before we move to Denali, because let me tell you, I spent 40 hours in Redmond in Denali training. This is the baseline before you go to Denali. If you don't have this stuff, you're not going to fully realize all the things that are coming in Denali. And I found I needed to get myself up to speed. So I know it's kind of unusual to have a presentation on existing products at TechEd, but we have so much functionality. So here's next steps. Here's related content. Here's some blogs. Here's some of my content. In case you're not aware, I have some books on business intelligence out there. And I have 1 minute, so I have to talk about the other passion in my life. So I have SQL, technical passion, and I have teaching kids programming. I'm the co-founder of a global organization that's created free courseware to teach children to program. And we are launching in Australia as part of TechEd. So I'm really, really excited. Go to that website and take a look. There'll be lots of information. I'm doing a bunch of media interviews this afternoon, and you can always just ping me. I've got a lot of people that are going to be working with me from Australia. So I am out of time. Hopefully you found this session to be of good value. Thank you for putting up with the microphone and my fumbling around up here. And thanks. Thank you.